my juvenile hall cell and was told I was going to prison. The day into my 18th birthday, I stepped foot on Chino State Prison's grounds. Prison is a weird thing. The psychology of it, you know, when you watch an entire calendar pass by from January to December, and then you just flip that shit back to January because you still got three more years to go. Okay, you just like,
I noticed I had a friend request on Facebook, and so I clicked the friend request, and it was a girl who had wrongfully accused and accused me of the crime, was now requesting to be my friend on Facebook.
Brian, thank you very much for sitting down and joining me. I appreciate you taking the time. Start us off there. Can you give us a bit of an idea of your background and what your growing up was like? Football was obviously an integral part, and getting to that eventually, if you could fill us in.
Yeah, absolutely. So before all the unfortunate events took place in my life, I grew up in the city of Long Beach, California. I was a product of three, an older sister, younger brother. And we pretty much grew up like every other, you know, young family in the inner city, you know, single mother. And she raised us good. She raised us right. You know, she taught us how to respect people, how to respect ourselves, how to, you know, knowing the difference between what's right and wrong, and always striving to be the best that you possibly can be. She was that person. So we always had that, that motivator, that teacher in our lives. And, you know, sports was also a big thing too. We got into track really, really, really early. We started running. I think that was the first sport that we got into. And then that moved on to basketball. Then eventually we, you know, at around, I want to say 9 or 10 years old is when I first tried my hand at contact football. And I didn't like it. I didn't like football in the beginning because when I was 9, 10, the way that they play football, or the way that they categorize you as a player, was not by age, it was by weight. So I was the size, I was a big kid when I was young, you know, so I was the size of, you know, 12-year-old, 11 and 12-year-olds. So here I was, 9 and 10. And so they put me in at, you know, the offensive lineman or defensive lineman. You got these guys full speed running through, you know, cracking into you. And I would go home with these dings on my arms and shoulders. And I didn't like it. I didn't care for it. So I remember after that year, I kind of was like, you know what, I'm going to focus more on basketball. Everybody was telling me, you're going to be about 6'10". You're going to be, you know, you're going to be giant, you know, start playing basketball. So I would always, you know, play the center position in basketball. But eventually I stopped growing tall. You know, I'm 6'4" now, but my extent of my basketball game is playing the center. I'm the size of a point guard. So anyways, but yeah, man, that's, you know, sports was always a part of our lives from a very, very early age. And it helped, you know, it helped us, I would say, a lot in being competitive and, you know, teamwork and, you know, socializing and learning how to take directions, you know. So it really played a huge part, you know. So our life, to sum it up, we were big into sports at a young age. Raised by a great mom who was, you know, very religious Christian. And, you know, we lived in a single parent household. So my mom did the best that she could.
So we'll start getting into the actual incident, or to be honest, lack of incident that, that altered your life forever. When was your first contact with the woman who would later make up the accusation?
Yeah, so, you know, she wasn't some random person. I had actually known her since middle school, which was, you know, grades 6 through 8. And my younger brother, myself, and her older sister all went to middle school together. And then eventually transitioned over to the same high school together. So we had known each other for a few years. And we had actually, you know, it's crazy because, you know, that wasn't our first time, you know, kind of flirting with each other, or you know, having that kind of space with each other. So it was the way things transpired, just to this day, just really just it just still doesn't make sense to me, you know.
What age were you at the time when the accusation was made?
Yeah. So this was in the year 2002. I was 16 years old. I'm 38 now. So in 2002, I was just ending my junior year in high school, my 11th grade. I was finishing that season, that football season off, ranked 11th in the nation as a middle linebacker. I was being recruited by a ton of schools, D1, D2, some of the biggest schools that, you know, are sought after today were looking into having me come play for their team. It was an amazing time, you know, knowing that my senior year was going to be the biggest year of high school for me. And I was going to be leading our school, our team's defense, and being a leader of the team. And, you know, I was in the paper at the time. I'm in the news at the time, and I'm dominating these camps and different things. And so everything was really starting to pick up. And this all took place the summer going into my senior year. We had practice coming up, but I had just finished what's called summer school. And after summer school, I think practice was maybe 2 or 3 hours after, you know, school was dismissed. And so a group of us players, we went and got some food that was down the street at the local burger place, came back to campus and sat around campus and waited for practice to start. And I remember sitting there, and we start seeing all these police officers coming onto our campus, and we were like, you know, trying to figure out what was going on. You know, our school was like what you would consider in the hood, like it was in, you know, pretty rough neighborhood growing up. It's not as rough as it is, as it was then. I mean, it still has parts. But during the time that I was there, it was
cop cars wouldn't be too rare.
Yeah, it wasn't rare to see police on our campus or around the campus. But in this case, it was an abundance of police officers, you know. I even got up from the seat that we were sitting at, the bench we were sitting at, walked over to one of the officers, and I asked him what was going on. And he just dismissed me. I guess he didn't know who I was or what exactly was going on himself at the time. So he was like, nothing. We're just taking care of something. I was like, all right. So I went and sat back down. And about a few minutes later, one of my teammates' dads, who always comes to all the practices, he comes on campus and he walks over to the table we're sitting at, and he pulls me to the side and he says, you know, I was walking on campus and I overheard some police say that they were looking for a kid by the last name of Banks. Do you know what's going on? Did you do anything? I'm like, nah, I didn't do anything today that, you know, would warrant the police to be looking for me. He was like, okay, well, you know, make sure you check with your younger brother. My brother was in his freshman year, his ninth grade year. And he's like, well, check with him and make sure he's okay. He didn't do anything or getting caught up in between some stuff. So that's okay. So I went over and I walked around to the other side of campus. My brother was in basketball practice. I pull him out of practice and I'm like, you know, questioning him. You know, it's really easy during this time in our neighborhood to get caught up in some street stuff, to get caught up in some neighborhood stuff, to get, you know, for arguments or fights to happen. It was just the nature of our neighborhood. So I'm, what'd you do today? What happened? He's like, I didn't do anything. I'm like, bro, you sure? Supposedly the police are here looking for somebody named Banks. He's like, I didn't get nothing. I'm like, okay, cool. Don't worry about it. I push him back to practice. I go back over and sit down somewhere like close to where the guys were, but I'm now sitting on the steps contemplating the situation. Like, why would the police be here looking for Banks? And within a few minutes, I'm like, you know what? This is nothing. I let it go. And I remember as soon as my mind was like, this is nothing, from the left side of me, I had this hoodie on. And from the left side of me, from where I was sitting, from the corner of my eye, I saw the girl who made the accusation. Her mom, her sister, and a few other police officers exiting the campus right to my left. I mean, they walked right by me. And I remember in my mind, still not thinking, you know, what I ultimately was arrested for. And I had no idea that that was, had anything to do with it. This girl at this time was known to be a troublemaker. She was getting caught up in a lot of stuff. You know, she was a bully on campus. Oh, her mother was a known gang member, in and out of prison, drugs. Like, they were a very rough, rough family. So, you know, so when I saw her leaving the campus, I'm like, oh God, you know, she did something. She's into something. They saw us walking around campus. Now, I'm going to rewind and tell you about the situation or the ordeal. But when that happened, when I saw her leaving the campus, my mind goes, okay, I'm out. Like, I'm going to leave. I'm going to call my mom and see what's going on, because this feels weird. So I stand up. I go the opposite way to where they were leaving. I run off campus. I go across the street to a buddy of mine's house where other players go after practice or before practice to play video games. His house was literally maybe four or five houses from the school. So I run over there. I bust in the door and I'm like panicking. I'm like, yo, the police, I think the police are looking for me. I think I'm caught up in something. So everybody's rolling on the ground laughing. And it just, it didn't make sense for us to be chased, or, you know, the police wanting us. It just didn't make sense, especially me and just the person that I was at, you know, and how I carried myself. It just didn't make sense. But I'm like, no, I need to, you know, let me use the phone. Let me call my mom, because I just want to make sure. And so I call her and I'm like, I think the police are looking for me. I think they want to talk to me about something. She's like, well, what did you do? I'm like, well, I didn't do anything. She's like, well, why would they want you? I was like, I have no idea. I don't know. I don't know. And she's like, well, if you think the police want to talk to you, they need to talk to you while I'm, you know, around. So come home. So I skip practice. I jump on a bus. I, you know, catch the city bus home. And I get there. I talk to my mom and we're talking it out. And she's like, this makes no sense. I think he overheard, you know, the player's dad overheard the wrong thing, maybe the wrong last name, you know, let it go. So I take mom's advice. I let it go. I walk into my room and I remember taking a shower and going to sleep. I remember taking a nap there. And this is 2002. So this was before cell phones. This was before, you know, chilling on internet and all of that. It was, you know, you only had a few things to do. I laid down, I took a nap. And I remember as I was sleeping in the middle of this nap, this crazy pressure just pushed into my back as I was, you know, laying on my stomach. And I remember jolting, like I jumped trying to get up. And there was somebody, you know, saying like, don't move, stay right there. Keep your hands behind your back. Don't move, don't move. So I'm like, all right, he's like, keep your hands down. So I got my hands down and like, tell me to put my hands behind my back. They're cuffing me, yanking me, pulling me up, you know, asking for me to put all these, you know, what clothes do you want to wear, and pick something out. And they're rushing me out of the house. My mom screaming on the floor hysterically. Like, it's just this big, crazy, crazy ordeal, man. And I remember getting shoved into a police car and whisked away. Now, the backstory to all of that is, earlier that day, I had stepped out of my class. I was during class of summer school. I was, there was a film that was being made about our high school football team. And they wanted to have focus pieces on certain players on our team, the leaders of our team. I was one of them. I remember the guy, the producer's name was Dan Freeman. And he had a company called Free Bird something. I still remember it because that was the whole reason for that. And the only very reason that I stepped out of class was to, they were supposed to show up on my campus that morning and film me moving about class. And later going to use this as part of the movie that they were filming. It was like a series for HBO or something like that. So I'm excited about this. I'm like, dude, they'll be following me around campus, cameras. And I'm like, you know, foot tapping, waiting for these guys to show up to school. And they're just not, you know, it's later and later and later. Finally, there was one girl, I believe, that I knew at this time that had a cell phone. Like, it really wasn't a big thing then. And I asked if I could, can I use your cell phone? Like, I got to make this call. I got to call this guy about this TV show. So she's like, cool. So I asked the teacher, can I step out of class to make a quick call. And the teacher said, if you're going to make, now this call would have been me stepping outside, right outside the door of the class, which was this class in particular, were in a set of bungalows that were away almost kind of from campus near the football and the baseball field. So it was a little bit of ways away. And it was these temporary bungalows that they were using while they were expanding portions of the school. So it would have been as simple as me stepping out of my class right there outside the door to make my phone call, and I would have came back in. But fate had a different storyline. My teacher said, well, if you're going to make a phone call, take these papers and deliver them to the front office for me. So I said, cool. I got the phone. He gave me the papers that needed to be turned in. And now my phone call that would have took place right outside the classroom now has me going over into the campus. As I'm walking to the front office to deliver these papers, I walk past the girl who made the accusation. She was on her way to use the restroom. And we began having a small talk. That small talk started flirting. That flirting led to us agreeing to go to a known makeout spot that was on our campus that everybody kind of knew was one of the places if you wanted to get away and not really be seen, that was a place you can go to. So we started making our way that way. Well, actually, I delivered the papers real quick. She waited. I came back. We started making our way. And we go to this area. We kiss. We make out. We touch. And that was it. I ended up leaving and going back to class and finishing class, finishing school, having food, coming back to campus, and then being approached by my teammate's dad saying that the police were looking for me. Fast forward through the story I gave you before then, I'm now in a police car and it all is starting from there.
Okay, so at the time, like when you were you actually arrested in your home or were you just brought? Because I know when they arrest you, they have to tell you what you're being arrested for.
Yes, so I was arrested in the house. I was read my rights, but I wasn't told what I was being arrested for until I was in a police car and being driven off. And I think it was because they were explaining everything to my mom, me being a minor, and maybe immediately, you know, me not knowing my rights or knowing what I should ask for. You know, I didn't say, you know, what am I being arrested for? What is it? You know, what's the charges? You know, I'm hysterical. I'm freaking out. I'm being, you know, pushed into my back. I'm seeing guns out. I'm being yanked from place to place. I'm being put into a police car. Everything's happening real fast before I can even calculate what's taking place. By the time I get into the car, I'm finally asking what's going on. Like, what is going on? And one of the officers finally tells me, man, it looks like somebody on your campus is accusing you of rape. I'm like, and that's when like everything started to go, and I'm putting pieces together. Why she was with the police, what we were doing earlier together. And it just hit me. I remember just sitting back in the police car. I was in the oddest position, the most painful. Those cars don't have much space. I was a big guy. And I remember just leaning back and just thinking like, there's no way that this will make sense to anybody. You can go ahead and question me if you want to. This is ridiculous. And I had no clue that was the last day of freedom for the next 5 years and 2 months.
Okay, so you get to the you get to the police station. Do they kind of present you with like with the accusation? I know there was obviously no kind of evidence that one could produce, but yeah, did they go into more detail with you?
So what happened first was, initially, I didn't go immediately to a police station. I went to a hospital. They took me to a hospital, and I did what was called a DNA testing kit for incidents of rape. And you know, it's really crazy, man. You know, you think about the whole idea of me being arrested for and being accused of taking advantage of someone, of kidnapping someone, of putting someone through something that they should never have to experience. When all the while, I was an innocent 16-year-old kid who was now in a hospital doing a DNA testing kit where they draw your blood, take your fingerprints, take your pictures, strip you down from your clothes, pull pubic hairs from you so that they can collect samples, scrape skin from certain areas so they can collect DNA samples. So now here I am. I'm the one being kidnapped, taken away from my family, my mom, who's at the time that I'm being picked and probed at, screaming and crying back at home, having no clue where her son is. I'm the one on a bed being picked and probed at in pictures and, you know, very compromising and uncomfortable and unwanted experience with no parent or any advisory there with me, you know, and then I'm being questioned after that by a detective at the hospital telling me before everything starts, man, I just, as long as you just tell me the truth, we'll figure this out, you'll be going home. And I should have never talked to that detective without my parent there. I should have never opened up. And you know, but I didn't know. I didn't know the laws. I didn't know what was what. You know, we didn't grow up in that environment where, hey, you know, you need to let me teach you the law and don't talk to the police. You know, there was no need for that.
Sorry,
And so I
did you say anything that would later kind of work against you? Because I mean, you were completely innocent. I assume you would have expressed that.
Yes, of course. But what happens in these types of cases, if you admit that you were in the if you admit that you were there and that you did engage in any form of fashion, they have a case. Doesn't matter whether you say, I didn't do it. Yes, I was there with her. And yes, we did kiss and make out. That's enough. That's enough. But I didn't do anything. That's enough. You got to go to court now. You got to, you know, there's two different stories here now. So now we're gonna charge you, and you're gonna, you know, versus if you didn't say anything, didn't talk at all, then I guess you later have an opportunity to present your side of things in a certain way. But that's part of the trick of the way our detectives and police officers go about interviews. Is by trying to get on your good side and appeal to you as that I'm here to help you. I'm here to get down to the bottom of this for the sake of you. When all in actuality is it's not that. I just want you to admit that you were there and that you engaged in some way, and I got myself a case. And so that's all it took. And no matter how many times I say it didn't happen, and I no matter how many times I say this is what actually happened. It was the simple fact that I said that, yeah, I was there. And something did happen, even though it wasn't anything that shouldn't. And so after the interview, I went to a police precinct where I sat for hours and hours and hours, where I was told over and over that everything would be okay. They just were doing some necessary investigating. But by the end of those hours,
At no stage, you're at no stage where your mother or the lawyer to come.
I was literally in a jail precinct holding tank for maybe 5 or 6 hours by myself, just sitting there. I had no phone call, no anything. I'm just sitting until they figure out what was next. And the whole time I'm freaking out. I couldn't believe I was handcuffed, arrested, all the stuff that happened with the doctor. And now I'm sitting in a jail cell, like a holding tank, and I'm just constantly thinking, like, dude, come open this door and let me out. Like, I'm thinking, this is, yeah, they're gonna come open this door and this is over. Time just kept going by, kept getting later and later. Eventually, they opened up the door and they said, you have to go to, juvenile hall, which is, juvenile jail. I was 16. They say, we got to go to juvenile hall for, to see the judge. And I was like, what do you mean, juvenile hall to see the judge? Like, yes, you got to go to juvenile hall and see a judge. And I'm thinking, the judge was at the juvenile hall, So I'm like, okay, but you're not going to be able to see him now because it's real late. So you probably have to see the judge tomorrow. I'm like, so I got to go to jail tonight for a day. And they're like, yeah, you got to go to jail. I'm freaking out that I got to go to jail for a day. I'm like, I can't believe, like, I'm like in my mind, like, calm down. Like, this is, you know, they're going to figure this out. Your mom's working on it. I remember they're cuffing me, put me in another police car, drive me across town to a juvenile hall called Los Padrinos Juvenile Hall. And they process me in, you know, this is stripping you down, making you shower, watching you shower, you know, making sure you don't have any weapons on you, patting you down, all this crazy stuff, intake. And I get to finally get to the module where they're going to house me. And it was so late that they couldn't put me into a new cell because they didn't have me processed all the way in. So they put me in this dorm where they usually set up for, you know, lunch and breakfast and dinner and game room. They put this little floor, I don't even know how to explain it. It's like a lifeboat type raft of a bed, but you put a mattress inside of it, and gave me a couple blankets and was like, hit the floor. This is you for tonight. And I did not sleep that entire night. I remember just laying there and just like, okay, I'm gonna let the sun come up and see this judge and say, what the hell? Like, this is crazy. Like, I'll be out of here. And then I wake up and I realize you don't see a judge until 72 hours. So that one day turned into 3 days. I finally get to court and the judge gives me a bond of 1.125 million or something like that, which was absolutely crazy.
It might as well be a billion.
I mean, where was I going to go? I'm a kid from the inner city. I have no international contacts or relationships. I have no money. We don't have the money for bond. So what was the plan? When, you know, like, where was I? I wanted to play football and be at school more than anything. The biggest year of my life at the time. Of course, I want to be home and continue moving on with my life, not go on the lam. This is just ridiculous that they impose such a high bail on a 16-year-old kid with no evidence, with just a he say, she say. And she has six different stories going into this. Excuse me, like this helicopter pass. I'm not sure if you can hear.
I can't even hear. You're fine. Yeah, whenever you're.
So that wasn't even the worst part. They posed the bond. They denied bail. They denied me to be released on my own recognizance, which is to be released without bail. And then they proposed a new court date that was 2 months out. So that one day turned into 3 days, and those 3 days after seeing a judge turned into two more months
of incarceration. Sorry. So by the time you saw the judge, you still hadn't met a lawyer or one been offered?
I mean, my mom had got me in contact with the first lawyer she knew. He was a family lawyer. We didn't know what to do in the beginning. He showed up for a day and then said, this is beyond me. You need to get somebody else. And a family friend introduced my mom to a lawyer, a woman who said she would take on the case. And it was for, I guess, I really don't know how much it was, but it was her fee was enough for my mom to have to sell her house, sell her car to pay for her and her private investigator that she recommended. She began working on my case. I would say I didn't see her, I think, until the second court date, which was the one that was 2 months out. She maybe came during that time and visited me at the prison, at the jail once. But it was different because, and it was unfortunately different because I was a minor, I was young. And so, you know, looking back on it, the way that she worked with me and dealt with me, in this case was really as if, you know, I was not really privy to anything. You know, I didn't get my case file until 2 years after being in prison, after being sentenced and sent to prison. And it was a whim that I got my case file. It wasn't because I requested it. It wasn't because she gave it to me. It was because someone felt I needed to see it. And that's how I got it. And that's what changed everything in my case, which is later in the story. But yeah, she showed up that court date, and then I began, like, things just started to happen very slowly, and that's how the court systems work. I went back in 2 months. They scheduled me to come back in a month. I went back in a month. They scheduled me out for another 2 months. You know, now it's the holidays, and so it was 2 more months. And so next thing you know, I was in jail for a year fighting the case, which I wasn't fighting anything. It was just a bunch of continuances. It was, we weren't ready, or let's schedule for this. And okay, well, this person's on vacation. Let's push it out for a month. Okay, well, now you got to do this hearing, and then so let's do that in a month. Oh, okay, well, we're not ready. Give me 2 more months. And you just show up to court just to get pushed back into the cell, you know. And there's just this never-ending psychological warfare of today is the day that when I go to court, they're gonna say, "Yo, oh, we've just figured it out. You know, you're going home now." And it just never happens. It never happens. They just keep pushing you along and pushing you along.
My understanding is that you were it didn't actually do like a trial and all that. You felt at the time that you were kind of screwed and that the best thing to do would be to take a plea bargain. When did that come about?
That's not quite how it happened. I had all the intentions of going to trial and fighting this case. I was very adamant about my innocence. So was my mom and my family, and we were going to fight this thing. My lawyer throughout this year of fighting the case was would present deals to me, plea bargains. You know, take this deal for juvenile life, which would mean you would stay in jail to the age of 25. No, you know, a plea to this and then you'll get 9 years. No. Okay. Well, now they're trying you as an adult. So I went from juvenile court, and then they said, "Well, you're not fit for juvenile court. This case is so severe, you're now being tried as an adult." I went to facing 41 years to life in prison at the age of 17 now. And then I was presented the 9 year deal, an 18 year deal, a 9 year deal. And I'm saying, no, I'm innocent. I'm fighting this case. Until one day, the day of jury selection, the day I was showing up for court to select a jury to go to trial, before I could walk in the courtroom and select jury, my lawyer pulled me into an interview room at the courthouse. She had this smile on her face as if she'd won something. And I was very excited to hear what this was. I'm on the other side of a window, a glass window. And I'm in this tiny little box, and she's on the, you know, the free side. So she walks in, she sits down, she's like, "I just came up with this amazing deal with the DA. This is a deal you got to take. Oh, this is it." I'm like, "Oh, here we go with another deal." And she says, "If you plead to no contest to one count of rape, which means that they would drop all the other charges that I was facing. No contest means that I'm not saying that I'm guilty, but I will take the burden of a guilty plea and allow you to sentence me to whatever you deem necessary. And for that, you will give me some form of leniency. You'll reduce me down to one count of rape." And then my lawyer said, "You'll undergo a 90-day diagnostic, a 90-day observation at Chino State Prison, which is known as one of the most notorious prisons in the state of California. For you know violence, and how you know tough it is surviving there in the conditions. But you would undergo 90 days there, and during that observation, you will be interviewed by a psychologist and a counselor who will determine on a ladder system whether you were to receive 3 years in prison, oh, excuse me, felony probation, 3 years, or 6 years in prison." And she said, "But Brian, I'm guaranteeing you, I promise you that you will get the favorable report and you will get probation. After the 90 days, you'll come home." And she said, "Yes, you'll have to deal with probation and all the things that come with that. But the bigger thing is that you will be home and this will be over. But if you go in there and you select a jury, this jury is going to see a big black teenager. They're going to automatically assume that you're guilty and you're not going to go home when you go to trial. I need to know what you want to do because I got to go in there right now and tell the DA your decision. What do you want to do? Can I talk to my mom?" "No, you can't talk to your mom. This is a decision that you got to make. And right now, you're in adult court. You got to make adult decisions. What do you want to do? Come on, you want life in prison, or you want to get this done in 90 days? What would you do? You know, I mean, what would you do if you really, you know, you're 17 years old, you've been in jail for a year almost, and they're telling you this could be over in 90 days if you gamble this out and you go to this prison and you bob and weave and try to stay alive. You know, this could be over in 90 days. Or you see how things have been going for you here. You've been in here almost a year. You can get life. You can get life. You can stay in here. What do you want to do? You know, and you can't talk to anybody. You can't sleep on it. You can't think about it. You can't go and contemplate. You got to make a decision now. I remember sitting there crying. Everything's falling out. How could this be? You know, this has to be another way, please. And she's like, let me know what you want to do. And I'm like, all right, I'll take the deal. I'm going to prison for 90 days. I'm going to try to knock this out. And I'm home. I can get back to playing football and get back to school and, you know, figure out the best of my life. And I remember walking to that courtroom. My mom and family were there. They were thinking I was about to select a jury. And I start pleading out to a deal and pleading no contest to one count. And everyone's breaking down crying. And I'm very confused at my, you know, like I'm still lost too. I'm confused and I'm just, you know, the judge is reading off conditions and I'm just like, yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And I turned around and told my family I love them when it was all said and done. And they took me out of the courtroom. And I was in juvenile hall for a few more weeks. I had my birthday July 24th, 2003. And July 25th, that following day, I was awakened early in the morning in my juvenile hall cell and was told I was going to prison. The day into my 18th birthday, I stepped foot on Chino State Prison's grounds. I began a 90-day sentence in prison.
So at this stage, you kind of thought that probably the most you were going to do was about 3 months, 90 days. How did it end up being 5 years, half a decade?
Yeah. Well, I went to Chino. I got the favorable report. The counselor I was interviewed by and the psychologist that I was interviewed by, they both recommended the favorable report. They both agreed that I shouldn't even be in jail, that the case was very weak and it made no sense. And they were very heartfelt that I was there. You know, they saw a young kid who was being pushed through a system. So they did the best that they could, which was the least sentencing possible. And you have no idea, like the sense of relief and joy in that moment that I had during that whole ordeal was finally to hear from somebody, from someone in this industry, this procedure, this whole thing. There was someone in the inside finally looking at me and saying, this shit don't make no sense. You shouldn't be here. This is crazy. And I'm just like, thank you. And it was back to back, both interviews. And I'm like, oh, thank you. So I remember writing my mom, because at this time when I was in prison, there was no contact with the outside world. There was no visits. There were no phone calls. There was only writing letters. So I wrote this letter to my mom, just telling her, like, I'm coming home. Like, we got it. Like, we got the favorable report. And finished the 90 days. I was taken out of prison, sent to now county jail because I was 18. And so I went from juvenile hall to prison to now LA County Jail, which was another thing in itself. For those who don't know anything about LA County Jail or Chino, it was rough. It was definitely an experience. So I eventually, in a few weeks from county jail, went back to court, stood in front of the judge, and the judge, after reading he read all of our character letters, and he allowed the person who made the accusation, he allowed the mother of that person to stand up and give a statement, which was one of those statements you would see on like crime TV, when someone committed the crime and the family's addressing that person, I experienced that. Like I was in a chair while I was berated by a parent who was telling me how I took advantage of their daughter and all of these inhumane things and what I really should be getting, and that this sentence was too soft. And it was just, I couldn't believe that I was hearing the stuff that I was hearing. Everything in me to not say something back and to just scream, I didn't do this. But after that, she sat down and the judge gave me the higher term of 6 years anyway, even with the favorable report. He skipped over probation, skipped over 3 years, and gave me the higher term of 6. I had never been arrested before, never been locked up, never been involved with the police in any, or the courts with anything. And here I was at 18 now with a 6-year sentence, and I had to serve 85% of that time, which was a total of 5 years and 2 months.
You mentioned there about prison being a fairly rough place. How did other prisoners, if you would even discuss it, how would other prisoners react when you told them that, look, I'm completely innocent. I didn't do this at all.
Yeah, prison is kind of a don't ask, don't tell environment. You don't go around pleading to other inmates about your case. They don't give a fuck. I mean, I'm dealing with what I'm dealing with too. I can give a shit if you're innocent. I'm innocent too. Like that, you know what I mean? Like we're all innocent up in here. If that's the case, like, so what? You know what I mean? I'm not the jury or the judge. I don't care. You know, so it's kind of like you don't go around pleading to other people dealing with, their own things. And you definitely don't open your mouth up about what you're in there for, especially when you're in there for something like what I'm in there for. I knew very early on that what I was in jail for was something that can get you killed. And so very quickly and very early on, I started to devise this whole story of why I was really in there. It was something totally different. If I was ever asked, it was that I was in there for a home invasion that some buddies of mine did to someone that we knew. And he threw my name in the pot with everyone. And so I got locked up and now we're dealing with that. So everybody always thought it was a home invasion. Now, mind you, other races, what I mean by race, I mean by the color of your skin, other races in the state of California move differently when it comes to new inmates coming into their space. For instance, white inmates and Hispanic inmates will require you to produce your court paperwork upon entering the facility. We want to see what you are in here for. And if you're in here for something like what I'm in here, what I was in there for, you'd be in a hell of a lot of trouble.
So, meaning that if you were white, the white people would make you show them? Or
absolutely. Yeah, as soon as you come in, let me see your paperwork. Yeah, pull out your court files.
But you never had to because...
It was more of we don't really care what you're in here for, as long as it's not something that is hitting the news line. Someone from on the outside has told us about you that you're bad business. Someone in here knows about you that you're bad business. As long as you are not bringing something that could hinder all of us by harboring you, and we didn't know that you were either, this or that, then it's kind of like, don't ask, don't tell. But if you bring attention to yourself or something brings attention to you, now we're going to come question you. So I was never asked coming into prison, per se, what are you in here for, and prove it. But for other inmates, it's totally different.
Given that you didn't have like a criminal past, and I'd have to imagine like if someone had been like kind of a gangster or kind of lived that sort of life for years, then they'd be at some sort of an advantage going into prison, given that they're used to dealing with the types in there and they might kind of know the lingo and so on. Did you feel it was like tougher for you, given that you didn't come from that type of background?
I grew up with the lingo, through my neighborhood. The lingo in prison is the lingo in the streets where I grew up. I grew up around the gangsters. I grew up around the criminals. I grew up around the hardened guys. Like, those were my, family members. those are my neighbors, those were my football coaches. Like, Long Beach in the early 90s, in the early 2000s, I mean the late 90s, early 2000s, it was a community where, some of the biggest gang members were also the high school, were also your Pop Warner football coach. You know what I mean? And it just was what it was, you know what I mean? So when I got arrested and I finally went to prison, I was able to reach out to family and certain folks that I knew to make phone calls for me to people that were already in there, that I was coming. So I was able to channel certain things and make certain things happen that, ultimately kind of helped me along the way. When I got to where I was going, people either knew who I was because of the people that I was able to get some word out to, or they just knew me from Long Beach. I was in the newspaper. I was on, you know what I mean? So there was one instance, only one, in the 5 years and 2 months that I was locked up, where there was this guy who, so in prison in California, you roll with your own people, and it's all broken down systematically. The highest level of breakdown is by race. First of all, you stick to your own race. The next level of that is not only do you stick to your own race, you stick to your own gang. And then it breaks down to either you stick to your own gang, or if you're not a gang member, then you stick to the city you're from. And then from that is it, from the city that you're from, you stick to that what's called a car, CAR. So if you're from this city, then all of you are in the same car together, driving through prison. We're navigating through prison together. We stick together in this car. So I was in the Long Beach car. I'm from Long Beach, California. And that was who I had to roll with and associate with. And there was one time, maybe 3 years, no, 2 years into my sentence, where there was a inmate that I was in there with, and he was my homeboy throughout the whole time. We were cool. Joked and laughed and ate and played ball together and all that stuff. And he was paroling, going home. And the day before he went home, he walked into my cell and closed the door, and he said, I just want you to know, like, this whole time, like, I know who you are. Like, I know what you in here for. And he said, I'm not tripping because I've already, made calls and, looked into you, and everybody on the streets is saying you're dealing with some bullshit. So I understand that, this didn't happen. He was like, but I want you to also understand what you not letting us know could have done to us as a car. We are carrying you around while you have this, and we don't know anything about it. He was like, all it could take is me to say something or somebody else, and it could be a totally different. Like, he pushed me to the side, and he kind of like, gave me like that, like, I know, you know what I mean? And that was only, and the dude was like, if worst came to worst, he was probably half my size, when he came into the cell. Like, between the two of us, I had no problem with what he was saying to me at the time, but I, from that 24 hours from once he said what he said to him leaving, was kind of like, oh, God, I hope he doesn't change his mind. And luckily nothing ever happened. But yeah, that's pretty much how it works, man. Yeah, you definitely could be in a whole hell of a trouble, based on what you're in there for.
How did you pass these 5 years of not having these things that you loved before, like your football, sports, friends? Did like a typical day play itself out over and over again?
Your life, the way you leave is two things happen. The way you leave the free world is one, how people will remember you, and two, how you will remember the free world. And especially when you're, I think it's hard to even deal with and cope with it as a person in prison who has actually committed a crime. You know what you did, you know why you're being sentenced. And you still, there's still the struggles of dealing with being taken away from everything you know to be true. Imagine that happening to you when you didn't do anything at all, when you actually are innocent. So yeah, I'm constantly being reminded of my, you know, my team. This is my senior year. Oh, this is the day of the first game. Oh, this is, you know, this is, here they are. They're getting recruited. Oh, they just walked on the graduation stage. Oh, yeah, this is the day that all my guys check into their scholarships at the new universities. And, you know, eventually you get to a point to where you just say, I have to let all of this go. I just got to let it go. And so I remember first couple years of incarceration, I was really into, like, you know, trying to watch a sports game on TV when I could, or trying to keep up on a newspaper with what was going on with my team and what was going on with the US, with USC. And eventually I just got to a point where I just shut it down. I was not going to get out of prison mentally sane if I continued to hang on to what was no longer real to me. I had to fully embrace where I was. You know, it's crazy because you prison is a weird thing. The psychology of it, you know, when you watch an entire calendar pass by from January to December, and then you just flip that shit back to January because you still got three more years to go. Okay. You just like, you count down, you literally will watch the countdown on a little small TV, and then you'll think to yourself, okay, three more to go. And you just reset it and you go back for, you know, and that's for me, and for others, it's okay, 17 more to go, 19, 28 more to go, you know, and it's just this craziness. Anyways, but yeah, man, you have to let it go. I had to let it go at some point and just no longer think about what once was and focus on what's now and how do I get through it and how do I, you know, who am I going to be and what am I going to be when it's all said and done.
How did you actually like fill the time with reading? Was there any amount of kind of athletic pursuit you could do? Obviously nothing close to what an elite athlete would have been doing outside, but.
Yeah, man. Most prisons do not allow you to run full speed. Something's not right. If you are running full speed, you going somewhere, you charging somebody, you know, so they won't let it, they, you know, they have tracks where you get your jog on, you get your few miles in. But I think any erratic movement, you know, that was not scheduled is no good. So, of course, I wasn't in there necessarily trying to, you know, stay in shape for sports or anything like that. But I spent my time after grieving for, a period of time, even while grieving. You know, I was able to meet a special individual early on in my ordeal who became a mentor to me, who in a lot of ways helped me navigate through what I was going through and gave me some tools to use along the way. So that really led me to taking a huge interest in books. I was reading, you know, a book or two a day. You just have nothing but hours and hours and time to do anything. And then I started getting into psychology and sociology and spiritual enlightenment texts. And I started getting into Afrocentricity. I started getting into random stuff, water treatment and plant operations. I was digging into literally whatever I could. I read the dictionary and the thesaurus twice. You know, I would write the words down and the definitions, and then I would apply them. And when I would go out to sale, I would start talking to people and would use these words, and they'd be like, "Yo, this motherfucker is just like, what are you saying right now? Like, what?" You know, I just developed this hunger for like wanting to understand life and religion and people, and I guess why am I going through this? Why is this happening to me? You know, why is life taking me down this path? And that really just unlocked the door to curiosity about myself, life, and, you know, and people. And so that's how I spend my time, man, just being really curious in books and studying and learning.
Sure. I'll fast forward a little bit. I don't want to keep you too long. The end of your, you served all the time that you were supposed to serve. What was it like getting out? Obviously, you still had I believe it was 5 years probation. So you weren't quite a free man Fully, yeah. But what was it like? What was it like getting out of prison after half a decade in there?
So I paroled August 29, 2007 at the age of 22. So I had spent my 17th, 18th, 19th, 20th, 21st, and 22nd birthday behind bars. At the age of 22, I paroled with the intentions of going back to school, pursuing, you know, a junior college and playing football. I really wanted to get back into playing sports and just trying to make the best of my life. I wasn't thinking NFL. I wasn't thinking, you know, and doing something bigger than, you know, just having an opportunity to play again. So I paroled and got into school. I actually had enrolled into a junior college with the help of some really cool and amazing people, along with the head coach of the junior college's football team. They helped me enroll in the school prior to being out of prison. So when I got out of prison, I was able to literally jump right into the beginning of the semester. And within a few days, I was not even a few days. I went to campus, I think the day I got out of prison. I got home and was with my family. And then after a couple hours, I jumped in the car with my brother and we drove up to Long Beach City College, because I think I got out, if I'm correct, it was a Wednesday that I got out. And that Friday or Saturday, I had a football game, which was, you know, you think about it, you know, 5 years, 2 months in prison, and then you give me a helmet and some shoulder pads. I got in and I talk about letting off some steam. It was bad. I was tearing some shit up out there. Just running, hitting stuff. Really no direction. Really not even fully understanding the plays or anything. Just go out there and kick off and just, it felt good, man. It was crazy. Just to be back out there playing again, you know. But
to be fair, it's a testament to you as an athlete. Like how many other athletes could take 5 or 6 years off, and then we'll get to it eventually. I mean, you eventually ended up in the NFL, but to take such important learning growth years off, not get new. I assume that you're not getting good nutrition in prison or anything, and you weren't able to exercise properly. Yeah, it's a testament to you as an athlete. Fair play.
Thank you, man. I appreciate that. Yeah, and I think just, you know, I think, yes, a testament as an athlete, but also just a testament to the joy of freedom. And that, you talk about chasing a euphoria, a rush, or a feeling. I don't think the birth of my son, my exoneration date, and the day I got out of prison are probably the most I've ever felt a rush of adrenaline, joy, and being alive. Yeah, like getting out of there was crazy. And so, yeah, just a couple of days later, you know, I remember that day I got out of prison. I went to the campus. I was getting all my stuff for school. I went and saw the coach, and they're giving me, they like fit me for my uniform. I'm trying on gear, and I'm just like, this is crazy. And I played my first game that week. And I had an opportunity to play a few games before the season. You know, I played the season. Actually, I didn't even get through the whole season. Within a few games, I got called into the parole office. I had a parole officer. I was on parole. And to just make a quick correction, you had mentioned probation. There's a distinction between probation and parole, where probation is when you've been convicted of a misdemeanor and versus a felony. When you've been given a misdemeanor for a petty theft or petty crime where you only went to the county jail for that, you can be placed on probation. If you've committed a felony which has sent you to prison, that is now means for either felony probation on a very small minor offense, which probably won't happen unless it was a very tiny offense. But for the most part, you're going to be on parole because you went to prison. And you paroled from prison. So I was given a mandatory sentence of 5 years of parole, strict custody parole with certain guidelines and restrictions. as a registered sex offender, which in the state of California, they will call a 290 registrant. And regardless of what your sex offense is, whether it was you walked out the house naked to get the newspaper and the neighbor's kids saw you, or you did some of the most heinous things ever, you are blanketed into the same process, system, and the way they treat you, and your requirements and your restrictions, all of it is the same. All of it is the same. So I could live within 2,000 feet of any school or park. I had to register wherever I lived as a sex offender. I was on the websites, the Megan Law, and all these different things. I had a curfew. I had to wear this GPS tracking device on my ankle for the whole 5 years that I was on parole. With that, I couldn't play football anymore because I couldn't leave the county under any circumstances of Los Angeles. I couldn't risk having this thing on my ankle being ripped or torn apart. So I didn't have it on my leg for the first few weeks of parole. They implemented this new law right after I got out that required us to wear the GPS tracking devices. So within a few weeks of being out, I was given this GPS. I had to quit football, and subsequently I just let go of school altogether. I said, well, fuck it, I'm just done with this. Like, this just put a, you know, it put me back into incarceration. I was locked up all over again. And so it just really messed me up, you know, and it took me a while to just kind of get back in line and figure things out and try to have that hope for pushing forward. But yeah, football was awesome, was over again. That wave of football was over once again.
Again, we'll fast forward a little bit. One of the more unique and fascinating things about your case is that you were eventually able to record the woman who made the false accusation. You were able to record and get physical video and audio proof that she made it up. You might take us to how that began.
Yeah. So,
how long after prison? I forgot to.
Yeah. So as I was given a 5 year sentence of parole post prison, and 4 years into the 5 year sentence, I was, you know, I hadn't been able to find any kind of work that was long term, any good jobs that actually wanted to hire me. And here I am 4 years later, still chugging away, trying to find some form of employment. I'm online doing the whole job searching, and I got bored and tired from it. So I wanted to take a break, and I go over to Facebook, and I noticed I had a friend request on Facebook. And so I clicked the friend request, and it was a girl who had wrongfully accused and accused me of the crime, was now requesting to be my friend on Facebook. And I remember slamming the laptop down and just kind of stepping away from it, and just I felt like I blanked out, not really blanked out, but I felt like I just left. Like, I just had like an out of body experience for my whole life, that whole ordeal of prison and everything, it just all flashed before my eyes. But I couldn't believe that I went through all of that. And now I have a friend request from the person who put me through it.
For no reason. It's not even as if you had some beef or some dispute and she was like, oh, fuck it, I'll do this.
We later, I think I'll get to that. But yes, you're right. You're right. And so I remember thinking that, you know, I've got two options here. I could get on here and just start going crazy with what I want to say, you know, mother this and this, this and that, and just rip one. Or I could play chess and not checkers and really figure out if this is actually her. And if it is actually her, if there's a way for her to tell the truth. So instead of freaking out and going crazy or blocking a page, I sent a message to her and I said, why would you friend request me? And the response within a few minutes came back, said, I was hoping we could let bygones be bygones. I was very immature back in the day. And I can assure you I'm very mature now, and you know, it'll be great to see you.
Wow.
My life flashed before my eyes again. Like, I'm just sitting here freaking, like, I'm shaking, I'm sweating. Like, it's just, it's hard to explain where I was in this time. And so I sent another message back and I said, would you call this number? Because I still didn't think that it was her. I was like, this just doesn't make sense. I went to prison. I'm on parole. I'm a sex offender. I'm lower than low. I'm dirt. Like, what, how could, you know, why would you, how is this happening? Like, it just didn't make sense. And the phone rang and it was her. And I remember just sitting there in silence for like a few minutes. We both just sitting there and I'm like, I'm listening. I'm like, I'm on my, like, you know, super radar. I'm listening, trying to listen into the back of the phone call and see what the sounds are back there. And if there's other people on the phone or what's going on. And so I'm like, why would you, you know, I'm with the questions. Why would you friend request me? And she's just kind of repeating what she said on the message, but then asking, have you seen my pictures on Facebook? I saw yours and, you know, you look good. Like, you've grown up. I love to see you. Have you seen my pictures? What do you think I look like? I was hoping we could hang out. Now I'm thinking, like, you know, prison has developed this intense amount of paranoia in my life where I'm constantly, you know, mindful of everything. And so now I'm thinking, you know, just it's really her, but she's trying to set me up to either go back to jail or to like kill me or something. Like, I don't know. My mind is everywhere. Like, this is a setup. This is something. This is not right. Something doesn't make sense. And so before dismissing it and going crazy, I'm still thinking chess, not checkers. I'm like, well, you know, maybe we could figure something out, but you got to come forward about what actually happened. And she says something along the lines of, well, we can hang out and you know, and chill. Maybe I'll think about helping you. And that was the conversation. And it went from there. I sat on it for a few days. I was dating this girl at the time and living with her. And for a few days, I just sat on it. Like, I didn't know what to do. I didn't call anybody. I didn't tell anybody. Like, I was just scared. I just thought that it was a trap. And so for those few days that I didn't do anything about it, she's texting me every moment of the day, every day. When can I see you? When do you want to hang out? When are you free? What area do you live in? Where are you now? What are you doing? Are you free now? Do you want to hang out or not? And I'm just like dodging it for a few days. And then eventually she texts me and she said, well, it looks like you don't want to hang out. So maybe I won't help you after all. And so I'm like, okay, I have to do something. And that's when I reached out to a friend of mine whose dad had just became a private investigator. I told my friend about it. And I said, should I talk to your dad about it? And I talked to him and he said, well, get her to show up, see if she'll confess. And we could do it at my office and we'll set up the cameras. And, so I told her, okay, you know, we can hang out, but maybe we could talk first. If you want to come to my job during my lunch break, we could talk. And that was really a private investigation firm. She ended up showing up 2 days in a row. And during those 2 days, she admitted to everything and more. We got it all on tape. It's on YouTube for people who want to go look it up. But we got all of that. And that was when things, oh man, so much happened. Like, so much happened, you know, during that time. Like, here it was, when she left that second day, she was interviewed by the private investigator, and she admitted everything to him on tape. And then when she left, we rejoiced and jumped and were screaming and going crazy. It was me, it was him, it was his wife. And we were just celebrating, screaming, and just happy that we got the recantation And this guy was so excited, the private investigator that was going on, he pulls out the USB drive that all the video was on while it was still downloading. And he corrupted the drive. Everything disappeared. Everything disappeared. People don't know this. Everything disappeared. And I think I put it in my book. It's in the book. Yeah, I wrote about it. And so he, I remember he sat there. He broke down crying right there. And I had no emotion. I couldn't even cry. I couldn't get mad. I just sat in a chair and I was just gone. My mom, I was just gone. And he's crying. His wife's crying. Eventually, we start reaching out to all these different repair companies that can repair this type of stuff. Found a guy who said he can do his best. Went there, and I think it was 48 hours of just. And he was able to recover 60% of all of the footage, not everything,
including the.
That 60% was everything that was needed. Yeah. It was about maybe 30% of the first day she came, which was just the two of us going back and forth talking. And it was really me trying to get her to understand all that I had gone through and experienced because of the lies. And every time I would say something that I was going through, she would just reply, "Oh, I was going through some stuff too. You know, I sued the school district for a lack of security. You know, that money they gave me," she got $1.5 million from a lawsuit. She said, "Well, you know, everybody was hating on me because I had all this money and everybody was trying to get money from me. And, you know, I started getting all these haters because I was, you know, I had this and I had that." And so it was hard. And then they wanted me, they were trying to make me do counseling, you know, because of this whole thing. I'm like, I didn't want to do that. And like, it was just like completely... just clueless to
you're the real victim here. Yeah.
So that was majority of that conversation went missing. But the second day that she showed up and she was interviewed by the private investigator, who literally was asking her just straightforward questions of, did this happen? Did this happen? Did this happen? We were able to recapture and save all of that stuff. So
did she go into, I assume the question of why would come up. Did she ever go into the why?
Not really why per se. She more so blamed and pointed the finger at other people. She said that she initially made up the lie. But then that lie grew when more people got involved. 1 second, I got a street sweeper going by now.
No, but I can't hear it anywhere.
Okay. So she, the way she tried to say it, now I don't know if this is true because you can't believe anything she says, but the way she tried to put it was that, you know, once other people like the police got involved and, you know, like I had to keep pushing it. Like I couldn't now, if it was, you know, a lie, then, you know, then that would look bad on me. Obviously, you know, I could only imagine what her mom, who was, you know, there was a lawsuit pending maybe days after I had got arrested. They were already ready to sue. Like the mom saw money right away.
Right.
And so I was, you know, I could only imagine if she would have came forward and said it never happened, her mom probably would have physically abused her or something. Who knows, whatever, you know? She said, and then what she said was, when I told them what happened, they would then tell me what you said happened, and it made me look like a liar. So I started adding more and more and more because I didn't want to look like a liar. So I remember, and it, so when she said that, it, certain things started to make sense. I was in prison. I was in jail when I was initially arrested for this, and it was for one count of rape. And then within a few days, it was two counts of rape. Then it was three counts of rape. Then it was kidnapping by force and fear. Then there were two counts of sodomy that even came up. Sodomy. Like, I'm 16 years old and I'm performing sodomy on high school campus. That's what's going on. Like, it was just crazy. And it was just what she was saying was they were just asking her questions. Well, did he do this? Did he do that? And she was saying, yep, yep, yep. Did he try to put it in here? Yep, yep, he did that. Yep. And so charges were just showing up and coming up. Now I'm facing 41 years to life. And so that basically was what the first conversation that she showed up at the office was about. And the second conversation was her being completely raw with her honesty in that it never happened. And we lost the footage. We got it back. When I got that footage back, I took control of it. I told the guy, give it to me. And I started reaching out to lawyers across the world. I mean, I just started emailing and phone calling. And then it hit me and said, oh yeah, California Innocence Project. I had reached out to them before when I was incarcerated. I was trying to appeal my case. That's a whole nother story within itself. But they had denied being able to help me because there was no newly discovered evidence in my case that could help. So now I had some newly discovered evidence, this recantation on video. I reached out to them and I remember Kim Hernandez, the program director, answered the phone and she heard my plea. They usually get their submissions from the mail from inmates that are locked up, people that are in prison. And I called and I'm like, ma'am, you know, please listen. I got something I think you guys really want to be a part of. And I've been fighting for a long time. I need you guys' help. So they agreed to meet with me at this location, which was crazy because I couldn't leave LA County. And California Innocence Project was in San Diego, 2 hours away. So I had to make a decision of do I leave the county and risk going back to jail because of the parole conditions and the GPS on my ankle? Or, you know, do I not go and meet them? So I remember telling the parole officer I had a job interview, but they requested me to go to headquarters, which are in Irvine. They did, the lawyers agreed to meet with me halfway in between LA and San Diego. So luckily he said, yeah, he gave me permission to go and meet for the interview, the job interview. I took this laptop with me that had the video footage on it with the hard drive. And I met with them. We sat in front of a Ralph's grocery store on one of the little tables where you could eat food. And I popped open the video and I started playing it for them and their jaws were just hanging on the ground and they just couldn't believe what they were seeing. And, I remember saying, you know, what do you guys think? And they said, you know, you don't need to worry about representation anymore. We're going to take your case. And I tried to keep my composure, you know, keep it all cool. And I remember saying thank you and getting back to my car. And I just went crazy. I'm screaming with joy. I'm banging on the roof of the car. I'm, you know, the accomplishment that I got them to take on my case, it was just huge. And that's the first time I felt like I had a moment where, you know, I could be getting my life back.
I won't keep you too much longer. But how did the process of actually getting exonerated go? Was it straightforward? Now that you have this evidence?
Not at all. Not at all. That was the beginning of a huge hurdle, because you know, in the state of California, the way recordings worked is the person needs to have knowledge that they're being recorded, which she, there were technicalities to it, because what we did was when we set up his private investigation office for this, we made sure that we put their signs of this place is recorded, that, you know, this, there is live recording. And we made sure we put it every 4 feet of his office hallway, from the front of the office door, going up the steps into the room. There were signs everywhere saying this place is recorded, this place is live, this place is recorded, this place is live. So that helped us with the law, but it did not help us with the judge. The judge could have easily and very well said, I don't like the way you guys got this evidence. You know, I'm not gonna allow it in court, and you guys still have the burden to show proof. It could have easily went that way. So in order to counteract that, we had to take this footage and go to the media. That was the plan, was we're going to jump over this by just showing the world what's going on. But that came with, you know, troubles of, you're going to show everybody that you were in contact with the victim in your case, which is an automatic violation of your parole, which could put you back into prison for 2+ years. You know, so to make a long story short, I felt that, you know, the weight of what's going on in my life was far more than the risk. So I took the risk, and we went to the media, we pushed it out, and it went for, before viral was viral, this went by this this went viral. It really took off, you know, within the city, within California. It really became a story right away. They found a DA, a former lead DA of Los Angeles, to actually come forward on that investigation with the news and say that he would have never took on the case. He would have thrown this out immediately, and they should throw it out right now. And that just really changed the game for us. Now we had communication and interaction compliance with the district attorney's office, who would later join in and a joint investigation with California Innocence Project and themselves into what actually happened, which never happens, you know. And ultimately, together, they all found out, and once they tracked this girl down who went on the run and did not want to be found, once she found out that she had been recorded confessing, they realized that this was all a lie, and it never happened. And May 24th, 2012, I walked into a courtroom as a guilty man, and I left exonerated, cleared of the conviction, and not only found innocent, but found factually innocent, which is a huge difference. Innocent means, if you're found innocent in court, that means that the court didn't have enough evidence to prove you guilty, although they still think that you are guilty. So it's like, you're innocent, but, you know, whatever, get out of here. Being found factually innocent is, we fucked up. You know, we messed up. This guy should have never been incarcerated, should have never been in jail, should have never been sentenced. This is on us. So I was found factually innocent, man. I walked out of that courtroom innocent. I was free. There were cameras and reporters everywhere. And one of the questions was, what now? And I said, now a quick backstory. When the California Innocence Project took on my case, it took an entire year for them to finally get me free, which in the world, or the space of wrongful conviction, a year fighting an appeal is extremely fast. Most of these cases take years for them to unravel and for the court systems to finally admit that they've made a mistake. And they will literally have to have their backs against the walls before they overturn the conviction. So it took a year. And during that year of fighting my case with the California Innocence Project, I told myself, if I get a window of opportunity of freedom, then I want to be ready for it. And I'm going to try football one more time. It was a dream that was taken away. It was a life that was taken away, and it was something that I needed to see to its end. So I got in the gym and started fighting in the gym while they were fighting my case for an entire year. I dropped about 35 pounds, got into the best shape of my life. So fast forward, being exonerated, standing in front of the sea of reporters, I told them, what now? I'm trying out for the NFL. There's a team that wants to give me a shot. I guarantee you I will outwork anybody on your team. And the next day I got a phone call from head coach for the Seattle Seahawks, Pete Carroll, who at the time was the head coach for USC, the team that was recruiting me in high school. And here we were, which I love to say, we were doing this kind of recruiting thing all over again, where he gave me an opportunity to try out for the Seattle Seahawks. Which then I was invited back to take part in camp, and ultimately not signed onto the team. I went on to try out for 5 other teams and eventually signed to the Atlanta Falcons. So.
Did you receive any type of compensation for your the wrong that was done to you? And did the woman in question ever face any type of legal repercussions?
Yeah. So in the state of California, and I say that because all states don't have this option, but you are entitled to $100 a day for every day that you have been wrongfully convicted. Now think about that for a second. Would you ever take a job where you worked 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for $100 a day? And not only work, but survive and have harsh conditions and be humiliated and degraded and be taken away from everything you know to be true for something that you didn't do. $100 a day. And there are stipulations to that as well. They will not compensate you for the days that you were incarcerated while fighting the case prior to being convicted. So that entire year that I was fighting the case in jail, I was not paid for. They will also not pay you for the 5 years of parole when you were a registered sex offender and all the other inhumane things that you endured those 5 years after prison. So I only got paid $100 a day for 4 years of my incarceration, which was a total of about $100,000 maybe. I don't really, $125, I'm not really sure, $225. Anyways, it was enough money for me to help get my life back in order to a degree, start to live a little bit, help my mom out. You know, it's really nothing compared to, you know, the experience and what you've gone through. Anything past that, now that even that money, you're entitled to it, but the courts are going to fight you on it. It's not a handoff. Even though you've been found factually innocent in court, you now have to come fight us again for the money. And we're going to fight for the money. Even though we found you factually innocent, we're going to stay. You know, it's not our fault that you were in that room with that girl or something. You know, they'll try to figure out a way to still not get you paid. But I was lucky enough to have so much media attention when I was exonerated. My story just took off worldwide. It was a worldwide story, and it really was so big that I think I was in a position where they couldn't deny the financial side of it, but still, it really is nothing compared to what, you know, the experience was.
Did the woman face any type of legal recourse?
Yeah, so she sued the school district for lack of security. She was awarded $1.5 million in settlement. Once I was found factually innocent, the courts and the school district countersued her, and they won for $2.5 million. But from my understanding, this person has nothing, not a dollar to their name, so they won't ever get that money. There's also a statute of limitation in the state of California where after 8 years, it is impossible to go after someone for perjury. So by the time that I was exonerated, it had been 10 years. So how could I go after her for criminal charges of perjury? And how would I know to do that or even have the right to do that while incarcerated? You know, so it's a strange system.
Do you think that the people who did what she did should get a similar jail sentence to what the...
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's no question about it. If you lied and your lie sent a person to prison where they've lost a significant amount of time, opportunity, life, freedom, then you should be subject to the same, if not more, for that. Absolutely. There's no question about it.
I agree with you. Final question. What does a man do post NFL?
Become a dad. Have a 4-year-old son and treat him like the world. He's given me a new perspective on life, on meaning, purpose. Continue to be a pillar for the voiceless, to raise up those voices that can't be heard, to fight for people who can't fight for themselves, to continue to raise awareness about the injustice of our system, the systematic disparities that we have, the broken flaws, the broken system that needs to be fixed, but also trying to not allow one moment in time to dictate the duration of my life, not allowing this to be the sole reason that you know of my name, you know, not living as a victim of circumstance for the rest of my life. I want more for me. I want more for me than anybody could want more for me. So today, I mean, I've gone on to play in the NFL, to working for the NFL's front office, hired by the commissioner of the NFL for 2 years, to hosting a television show on Oxygen, where I further investigated cases of wrongful conviction, to being the subject of a feature film called Brian Banks that came out in 2019, to being an author and writing my book about my life and my journey, and to being a nationally and internationally recognized motivational speaker and public speaker, and traveling, continuing to spread the word of the voiceless, as well as champion for resilience, and pushing, helping people to recognize their inner strengths and pushing forward through some of the worst times of their lives. So yeah, I'm staying busy. I'm also the CEO of a brand new PR company, BKB PR, where we are helping companies tell their stories, their authentic stories, and helping them to amplify their mission. So it's been awesome what we're doing right away. And I'm looking forward to continuing to expand on that and working with various people and companies.
Good stuff, man. I was going to say, you used the word resilient like at so many points during your story. I think a lot of people would have said, I'm done with this. I'm giving up. I'm done with the hassle. But to be that persistent, fair play to you, man. In general, you're probably almost tired of hearing it, but good for you for everything. I'm delighted for you. You got your life back on track. Like,
yeah, brother. Thank you, man. I appreciate that. You know, it's to me, you know, it just doesn't make sense to go through what I went through and to just be silent about it. You know, the tragedy of wrongful convictions is something that I've lived through, and we need to reform how evidence is handled and ensure that there's always room for evaluation and reevaluation when the facts come to light. It's about justice, not convictions, you know. And there's so many other points to it as well. You know, juvenile justice reform, you know, as someone who was thrust into the system as a teenager, I can't stress enough the need for juvenile justice. You know, we need to focus on rehabilitation and education, not punishment, you know, and how we go about our plea bargains and our system reforms. And it's just so much, man, that needs to be discussed and talked about. So I'm, you know, I try to do my part, you know, and then also give people hope that what you're going through is not the end. If you allow it to be the beginning of something, then it can be. And, you know, no experience comes with emotion. We apply emotions to experiences. You know, what we go through in life is one part, but how we choose to feel about it, how we choose to allow it to affect us, is always in our control. We always have control over that. So I try to deliver that message as much as I can as well.
Very good. Thank you very much for all your time, everything you've shared. Very personal. And indeed like an intimate time of your life you spoke about. And any final thoughts you want to leave us with?
Just to continue to keep up with me on the journey. You know, I can be found at brianbanksfree.com. And anyone who's interested in amplifying their narrative, their story through PR, we could be reached at bkbpr.com.
Thank you very much again. Have a good day, mate.
Amen.